Welcome back to PS Editors Podcast. I'm Greg Bruno. The recent rise of right-wing populism in the West is often blamed on globalization and national governments' loss of authority over domestic affairs, including their borders. And yet, anti-establishment nationalist parties are benefiting even where the economy is outperforming regionally and worldwide. A case in point is Germany, where unemployment is lower and growth stronger than at any time since the fall of the Iron Curtain. And yet, in September 2017, Alternative für Deutschland, or AfD, became the first far-right party to enter the Bundestag since the end of World War II.
Angela Merkel has been re-elected for a fourth term, but it's a hollow victory given the pummeling that she and her former coalition partners received and the success of the far-right nationalist Alternative for Germany party. The AfD, which promised to fight an invasion of foreigners, seems to have capitalized on a backlash over Mrs. Merkel's decision to open Germany's borders to over a million migrants and refugees in 2015.
And since the election and the reformation of Angela Merkel's grand coalition with the Social Democrats, the AfD has benefited further from its status as the largest opposition party. My guest today is Dalia Marin, a professor of economics at the Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich and a fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We'll discuss Germany's populists, where they came from, the factors underlying their rise, and whether their brand of politics is here to stay. Hi, is this Dalia?
Yes, this is Dalia.
Hi, this is Greg Bruno at Project Syndicate. Thanks for joining us today at PS Editors Podcast.
I am pleased.
Well, we are as well, and let's dive right into the conversation, if we could. I want to start with an overview of today's political landscape in Germany, much in the news. In last year's parliamentary election, the AfD party won 12.6% of the vote, which was the best showing ever for a right-wing political party in Germany's post-World War II era. Now, in your most recent PS commentary, you argued that for us to understand this outcome, we need to look at Germany's economic history. So if you could, just briefly walk us through what's happened to the German economy since the fall of the Iron Curtain, and how has that affected German politics today?
Yes, in the 90s, Germany was doing very badly. This was the time when the Iron Curtain fell. And so people were saying, okay, the opening up to the communist countries made Germany sort of sclerotic. And during this period, Germany was called by some people the sick man of Europe. Unemployment was tremendously high and so on. Now, what we find in our book is the opposite. Actually, what we find is that the liberalization of trade with the former Eastern communist countries actually had a profound rejuvenating effect on the German economy. I would say there was a big turnaround because Germany went from a high-wage, high-cost country to a low-wage, low-cost country without losing its big advantage, namely to produce high quality.
So that's interesting. That's some of the history that explains the strength of the German economy. But let's fast forward now to the 2017 elections, when the Alternative für Deutschland party gains an extremely large, historically large share of the vote. First, before we get into the specifics of why that happened, I wonder if you can talk about some of the things that I believe you're suggesting didn't contribute to it. The traditional issues like job displacement and import competition or other byproducts of globalization. Germany had a very strong economy in 2017. It continues to be strong. Were these issues that I just mentioned simply not a factor in the election and the rise of populism, or were they simply not as big as they've been in other countries?
Both, I would say. It wasn't as big. So this was one thing, because unemployment during this period, unemployment kept on declining. So what we find in the studies is that Unemployment has an effect on voting behavior. So if unemployment is increasing, that would have contributed to a polarization. But during this period, Germany had a declining unemployment rate, so that cannot be a contributor. So that this is very interesting because we find in our book that there is a high correlation between the votes for the AfD, the right-wing party in Germany. There is a high correlation of municipalities that voted for the AfD in 2015 and the share of votes for the Nazi party in the 20s and 30s. So there is a historical correlation between the two, while the share of immigrants in a municipality actually is negatively correlated with the vote for the AfD. Although this correlation is not significant, but it does show that immigration is a big topic in the political debate and in the campaign. While when you look at the actual numbers, it doesn't seem to support this.
So in municipalities that voted in a high turnout for the AfD, historically also voted for the Nazi Party back in the 20s and 30s, but in these same areas or potentially in other areas where the percentage of immigrants was high, support for the populace declined. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's what came out. Yes.
Interesting. And so what's the theory as to why that's the case?
So basically, I mean, there are two theories why people vote for populist parties. One is the economic hardship. So basically, this is the view that is taken by economists and political scientists, that when a group is, I mean, we know that trade has distributional effects. It leads to losers and winners. And so globalization leads to losers because some of them will lose. And so economists and political scientists say that losers from globalization tend to vote for right-wing parties. Now, this actually didn't happen in Germany. So there must be something else. So why is there an AfD? So the other view is that it's history. It's basically there is a basic cultural norm in the population that dates back very far back in history, and this hatred gets activated by certain events. In this case, it is the AfD, because the AfD started to become a populist party in the 2015 elections. Before the AfD was not. It was basically a party that was against the euro and the party that was against bailing out Greece, but they didn't have any nationalistic connotations. So that happened when a new leadership in the party took over and they started to become xenophobic. Mm. And this xenophobic supply of xenophobic feelings met a xenophobic tendency in the population that persisted over generations. And so this is how it is explained. So a very interesting paper that looked at anti-Semitism over 600 years in Germany.
I found this stat to be particularly interesting, that xenophobic attitudes can last for centuries, as you noted.
Centuries, yes, it's amazing. So what they find is basically, they look as an indicator for anti-Semitism, they look at pogroms in the Middle Ages. So they have data on pogroms against Jews in the Middle Ages, and they use these data to show basically that these programs in the Middle Ages reliably predict attacks on Jews in the 20s and 30s, attacks on Jews, deportations to concentration camps, attacks on synagogues, and so on. So this is 600 years. So it's quite. It's striking. I have to say it's striking. Actually, there is also a study for this is not only Germany. I don't want to blame Germany because You also see it in Spain, for instance. In Spain, since 1400, there are no Jews in Spain, but there is a game that children play. It's called Killing Jews around Eastern time. And so they play it in spite of the fact that Jews are absent from these countries since centuries.
Interestingly, though, in Germany's case, this wasn't supposed to happen. I mean, after World War II, the introduction of the Basic Law was meant to curb extremists' ability to unify and mobilize politically. You know, and underpinning this law was this decades-long process known as coming to terms with the past, or in German, Vergangenheitsbewältigung. I don't know how my pronunciation is in German. You know, that process has throughout German's modern history played a defining role in post-war education systems, literature, culture, and how we talk about history more broadly. But do you think that AfD's rise and its support in these areas that you pointed out that once had strong support for Nazis is evidence of the limits of this idea that it's possible to impose a state-sanctioned effort to overcome the past?
Yeah. I think yes. I think it helps if the state declares publicly that it has a great disgust for this party, and the German parties do so. It helps. And it also helps that it declares that we are committed to our Jews, as the German government says. There are big efforts now to see how one can deal with this problem, because, you know, I mean, statistics show that the amount of anti-Semitism hasn't actually increased. What has increased is the expression of anti-Semitic feelings because of the internet and the social media. So suddenly you see it on paper or on digital pages, the hatred that is still there in the population, and that came as a big shock. Because basically everybody thought in Germany we are doing all the best to get rid of this. And so I think there is now a major attempt. The government installed somebody who is responsible to cope with anti-Semitism in the country. There is a Beauftragter, as it is called. So there is somebody responsible for these things in Germany. And so we'll see what will happen. But basically, you know, when you look at this, there is a theory. Where is this coming from? And this is a theory of cultural transmission. So how does that happen, that over generations this hatred gets transmitted? And it's basically in the family, in children learn from their parents, and the parents have their norms, and they transplant their norms in their children. So when you want to cope with this, you have to start there. You have to start where the education. I was recently in Berchtesgaden, which is where Hitler had his second government residence. It's okay. In the mountains near Munich, and they have a documentary there. And when I went through, I haven't seen this before, but when I went through, there was a little child book that has been created by the Nazis. And when you look at it, I mean, these are pictures that go so deeply, you know, I mean, of anti-Semitic traits. Yeah. So it's very deep. So I think when you want to cope with this, this will need to go to the schooling system. And
I was just going to say that, you know, there's a historical connection, and what some sociologists would call collective memory is hard to uproot. But there's also a political piece here. I mean, part of Germany's post-World War II efforts to overcome the past, I think, had the as we look at it through the lens of populism, the negative ability of suppressing nationalism and subsuming sovereignty that has now become part of the European Union narrative. And for those looking for alternatives and more of a German narrative or a German history, AfD is really the only party questioning the bargain that's been established.
Yes. This historical study that I cited before, they also find that municipalities and cities that had a stronger exposure to long-term, long-distance trade were also those who were less, in which the transmission of hatred was less. So that suggests that having a society opening up to trade is actually good for coping with hatred and xenophobic feelings, because basically the theory goes like that. This is actually a theory that this has been proposed by sociologists and psychologists. It's basically the theory of intergroup contact. So the more contact you have to foreigners, the more your hatred gets reduced, because you have actual experience with these people and you find out that they are just normal people and you might like them. And so actually this contact theory suggests that it's good if you have exposure to immigration and exposure to trade to cope also with the form of historical anxieties and xenophobic feelings.
Right, which might actually explain the findings that you cite regarding areas with high immigrant numbers actually not supporting AfD.
Yes, exactly. Actually, there is another study on Brexit, which has been undertaken by economists from the University of Warwick, and they also find that who supported the Brexit vote. So, and they ask how much of it was trade and immigration. And actually they find a very low influence. They find some support for this, but it only explains a low share of the voting for Brexit. What mattered for Brexit was education, was whether you belong to the manufacturing sector. And when you look at the Brexit, the discussion before the vote, the debate was only about immigration. Everybody discussed that the immigrants are the reason why we have no control over immigration, and that's why we have to get out of the European Union. But when you look at the actual voting behavior, this did not matter. What mattered, actually, there is one effect that mattered, basically, because Britain was besides Sweden, the only country that opened up the labor market to the Eastern European countries and they entered the European Union. Germany and Austria didn't do this. So they had a big inflow of Polish immigrants. And so these immigrants from Eastern Europe, they had a higher share of immigrants from Eastern Europe supported the vote for the Brexit. But what that suggests is that the political scientists and economists are not wrong, that if a group gets hurt by immigration, they will vote for a party that says it's against immigration. So this is not surprising.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a good place to bring it back to current events and bring this conversation full circle. We recently had Mark Leonard, who's the director of the European Council on Foreign Relations, here on the podcast, and he argued that the future of European populism will unfold in one of three ways. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
One outcome is that they try and govern and they fail miserably, and that therefore allows Italy to its cathartic moment of getting this moment of revolt out of their system, but then they can return to more mainstream politics. Another outcome is that the parties themselves are on both sides, both the governing parties and the opposition parties, change as a result of this, that the Five Star Movement and the Lega actually become more sensible and govern in a way which doesn't fundamentally threaten either the European Union or the sort of country that Italy wants to be. Or the third kind of possibility is that they are very successful in implementing their policy program, and that Italy does become a much less open and much more Eurosceptic party, and that they create this sort of template for the whole of the EU to move in a much more anti-immigrant, less sort of open direction, and that would be a much more frightening scenario.
So what do you make of those three scenarios in general, and particularly placing them in the German context, where we're seeing a schism develop now between Chancellor Angela Merkel and her interior minister, Horst Seehofer, who's taking an increasingly anti-migrant and populist path? What does the future of populism for Europe look like in your mind?
It's hard to say, but I would say they will introduce policies that will not hurt the European project. That's what I think, because you know, I mean, look at the European project. Look what happened in the past. Everybody predicted that this is not going to survive because the economics doesn't speak for the European project. And but then when you looked at the actual behavior of the political elite, they really tried very hard to save the project in spite of all the headwinds. So I believe that this is going to happen here too. So even though that you have now a populist government in Italy, we have to see what they are going to do. I mean, they already declared they don't want to get out of the euro. So and they are for Europe. So slowly, I think the cost of getting out is just too high. One of the reasons why populism is there is also because the population has doesn't trust the political elite anymore. And why is that? And I think there are two reasons for that. Because if you look at Southern Europe, for instance, in Southern Europe, the story that I'm telling you about Germany does not really apply. Because in Southern Europe, these economies were exposed to a tremendous shock from China, because they basically had a comparative advantage in the same sectors as China has. And so so in these countries, and that happened, and then the financial crisis happened. And during the financial crisis, there was these austerity policies. And so you had the trade shock that hit these countries very much. Then you had the austerity policies at the same time. And now when you look at what did the government do actually to help these people to adjust? And it's very little. I mean, we know that trade shocks have losers and gainers. And we always say in our textbooks that you have to compensate the losers. But when you look at actual policy, it didn't happen. And that during a time when there was severe austerity. So it's actually not surprising that it's not that surprising. So given what hardship already happened in the past, and the strong will of the political elite to stay with the European project, I think it will be hard, but I think it's going to be there.
Well, so the European project is strong, but I think as this conversation has illuminated and Germany's experience illustrates, that the solutions might be much more complex than we've thought about them up until this point.
Yes.
Well, I think maybe that's a good place to leave it, and we'll talk solutions next time. But thank you very much for that fascinating overview of Germany's economic past and political present.
Yes, thank you. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
That was Dalia Marin, professor of economics at the Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich, a fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and editor of the new book, Explaining Germany's Exceptional Recovery. That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate and review our podcast and subscribe on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and iTunes. And if you like what you hear, why not subscribe to our newest editorial offering, On Point, available at www.project-syndicate.org. Until next time, I'm Greg Bruno.